This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The following advertisement feature is presented by GoTurkey.
Ever thought about taking a detour?
Turkey is known for its breathtaking beaches and mouth-watering kebabs. But did you know it's also a hub of ancient histories, a verdant land for produce and wine, and home to Michelin-star cuisine that surprises and delights? What more could you ask for? Look no further than the Aegean region of Turkey. It has it all. Discover culinary excellence in Urla, Izmir by sampling local produce in restaurants along the way. Experience history in Teos, an ancient Ionian city in Seferisa, where they loved a good glass of wine so much they built temples in honour of Dionysus, the god of wine and theatre himself. And feel the sand beneath your feet along the Aegean's stunning beaches. Or maybe the wind through your hair, kite surfing along the Alecica coastline. Turkey isn't just about the sun lounger, it's about the adrenaline. If you thought you had Turkey all figured out, try out the Turkegean lifestyle.
We've had seismic changes in the last decade, and we've adapted to them. But what comes next?
We really talk about autonomous business processes rather than just automating business processes.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Our latest episode explores how to build a digital brain and future-proof your business. Vision to Value on Resilient Edge is available now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the metaversal mind chamber where you, me, the top experts and a big subject collide and then resolve for 28 minutes. This week, the war in Ukraine, started by Vladimir Putin, has lasted into the new year, killing tens of thousands, costing billions and disrupting economies across the world. So today, where has the conflict got to, and what are the prospects for peace in 2023? Moscow, midnight on New Year's Eve, and a patriotic knees-up on state TV. Meanwhile, at the very same time, 650 kilometres away, in the town of Makiivka, in an occupied part of Ukraine, the world ended for dozens of Russian soldiers.
In one of the deadliest attacks on Russian forces since their invasion of Ukraine, the Kremlin says 63 of its servicemen have been killed after a missile attack on a Russian base in the Donetsk region.
It's widely believed that the number killed, probably by US-supplied precision missiles, was much higher than the Russians have admitted. Since then, Russian mass drone attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure have continued with the aim of wearing down Kyiv's resolve. So, as 2023 begins, how is the war going? And can the protagonists and their supporters sustain it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To begin with, I want to understand the current military situation in Ukraine and how the tactics are evolving. Joining me in the briefing room is Michael Clark, Professor of Defence Studies at King's College London and Specialist Advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy. Michael Clark, can you recap for us the major military developments over the last couple of months, say since the beginning of November?
Yes, the Ukrainians have conducted a fairly vigorous strategic counteroffensive. Before that, they were losing slowly and doing very well. But in July, they began an offensive, and in late October, November, they began a strategic offensive, which is to take back big swathes of territory, which they did in Kharkiv region, and have put pressure on the Russians now in Luhansk and Donetsk, which is the areas where the Russians say they want to consolidate. And then meanwhile, they also conducted an offensive in Kherson, down in the southwest, and they forced the Russians to withdraw from the city, the only significant city which the Russians had occupied, Kherson, and they made them withdraw from it. And so they control the west bank of the Dnieper River, and the Russians are on the eastern side, shelling the city of Kherson now. And so that's where we are with the war. Both sides, in a sense, are not moving very far now. The Russians are digging in. They're not trying any offensives at all. They're digging in for the winter, waiting for a counteroffensive in the spring. The Ukrainians are continuing to push, even though it's winter, and they would like to push their offensive, particularly in Luhansk and Donetsk, in the area of Svatove and Kramina, a very important area. And I think they will continue to push that. Whether they can open up another strategic offensive before the spring is questionable.
Right. I hear a lot about this particular place, Bakhmut. Why is there so much concentration of fighting in this place, and how much is there?
Bakhmut has become the centre of the conflict as it exists up in the northeast at the moment. And it's significant only because the Russians have made it so. Bakhmut is a small town, originally 80-odd thousand people, now down to far fewer than 10,000. It's a shell of a place. But it was one place on the road to Kramina and Kramatorsk, which were the two next strategic objectives of the Russians in that area. But they've not got anywhere near it. And they've made Bakhmut a sort of symbol of their ability to take somewhere. And the reason they've done that is not because it seems to have been a Russian general staff decision, but because it's the decision of Prigozhin, who is the leader of the Wagner Group, the mercenary group who mobilized men, their own mercenaries, and now, of course, a lot of convicts that they've recruited, about 30-odd thousand of them, from prisons around Russia. And Prigozhin seems to have made Bakhmut into his personal objective to show the Kremlin that he can take somewhere where everywhere else the Russians are falling back, and as an indication that he is the only successful commander that they've got. But what the Russians have been doing is almost launching human wave attacks, first to the north, then to the east, now to the south of Bakhmut, and they are putting more and more troops into it. They're dying in very large numbers. The Ukrainians are still holding on in Bakhmut, and the Ukrainians, I think, have decided that they will hold Bakhmut for symbolic reasons as well, since the Russians are spending so much effort and losing so many troops and so much equipment in trying to take it.
It seems strange when we're talking about a modern conflict with so much technology to put so much emphasis on the weather. But is it really the case that wintertime actually alters the calculations of both sides about what they can do and the realities of what they can do?
Yes, even in modern warfare, weather does matter, and it works in different ways. By and large, winter makes it easier for defenders and harder for attackers, because attackers have got to keep moving forward, they've got to keep all their equipment operating properly, and they've got to, as it were, be more active all the time, whereas defenders have got to hold a position. I mean, winter is miserable for everybody, and this winter hasn't become too severe yet, which is interesting. And then other things change. When the ground gets very hard, that's better for armoured vehicles and for tracked vehicles, so that can favour the attacker. On the other hand, you lose foliage cover in woodlands, and so it's harder to conceal yourself in winter, easier to conceal yourself in summer. So there are pros and cons.
So with the exception of Russia in Bakhmut, which you've identified as partially being down to the ego of this guy Prigozhin, has Russia's emphasis been on making Ukraine feel uncomfortable in the winter by targeting the electricity supply? Is that essentially been their strategic approach?
Since General Surovikin took over in early October, after the attack on the Kerch Bridge on the 8th of October, the strategy that the Russians have adopted has been the most coherent it's been since the start of the war. Surovikin is a ruthless commander, and his strategy is actually very coherent. Whether it will work or not, we don't know, but it is coherent. And his strategy is to withdraw troops from where they're not doing any good, like west of the Dnieper, not doing any good if all they're doing is sitting in Kherson. So pull the troops out, only fight the battles you expect to win, hold on for a major offensive next year, and in the meantime, bomb the critical national infrastructure of Ukraine so as to put them under pressure, to make them realize that this war will go on and will not be easy for them. I mean, he is reputed to have said, I am not going to fight a guerrilla war. I'm not going to spend Russian lives chasing NATO fanatics around the country. He says, we have technical means, that was the phrase he used, technical means to make the Ukrainians surrender. And that was the other word he used, to make them surrender. He's putting great pressure on Ukraine and communicating to the outside world that the Russians will not give up. This will go on this winter and next winter and the winter after if necessary.
Have these Iranian drones that we've seen and heard so much about, especially in relation to attacks on Kyiv, have they changed the calculus in any way?
The Iranian drones have not been strategically so important, mainly because they are being shot down at a rate of about 90% in each attack. But these Shahed 136 drones can be used in high numbers. They only cost about 20,000 each, so they're very cheap. They're a lot cheaper than the missiles used to shoot them down, which is a long-term consideration. And the Russians calculate, I think, that if they can keep on, as it were, trying to overwhelm the anti-aircraft defense system of Ukraine, eventually they'll get through in higher numbers and do more damage to the Ukrainian national infrastructure. As things stand, the Ukrainian critical national infrastructure is being taken down to a level of about 50% for quite significant periods of time. It's been brought back up again to 70%, 75%, and then it's taken down again to 50%, 40% for short periods. So this new type of war is between drones and the ability of maintenance crews to keep on repairing the substations that are being hit repeatedly when some of these drones get through.
In other comparable conflicts, if we can think of any, how much of the national infrastructure has been destroyed in those conflicts? In other words, I suppose the question I'm asking really is, how far can you cope with the infrastructure being damaged?
Usually, infrastructure in other conflicts is damaged to enormous extents in the final phases of a conflict when a country is clearly losing. I mean, this is a relatively unique case because what Sorovikin is doing is it's clever enough. I mean, if the Allies have been able to do this in the Second World War to Germany to actually attack the infrastructure a bit more significantly, then things might have been different. And so what he's trying to do to Ukraine is actually reduce Ukraine's ability to function as a society long before Ukraine has been defeated on the battlefield. And there is some logic to that. What the outcome will be, I don't know, because it's a fairly unique situation. And I can't think of examples in previous wars where infrastructure could be attacked quite so precisely as it's being in this case. And one of the reasons it can be attacked so precisely is because the electrical infrastructure, the whole power grid in Ukraine, was part of the old Soviet system, and the Russians know where everything is.
Michael Clark, now I want to try and understand how sustainable the conflict is for those directly involved, Ukraine and Russia, and for those committed to their support, notably the US and Europe. Joining me in the briefing room are Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, Samantha De Benden, Associate Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs at Chatham House, and Shashank Joshi, Defence Editor of The Economist. Lawrence Freedman, let's start with Russia and weapons. At first, it was Ukraine who we were told was struggling to get enough weapons. But does Russia, after all this time, now have its own issues?
Well, Russia's had issues with weapons from quite early on in the war. It used up a lot of its precision-guided munitions in the first assault. It's been relying on old-fashioned artillery barrages in many ways since, except for the attacks on Ukrainian civil infrastructure, where it has been able to use cruise missiles and drones and so on with more accuracy, but that's already affected its tactics. Russian approach is always to make do with what it has. And so it has stocks, it has numbers, it claims they have artillery shortages. A lot of its problems are about not so much whether they have stuff in stock, that's an issue, but whether or not they can get it to the front. And so there are issues of logistics. And as we've seen with some of the recent attacks on Makiiva and elsewhere, targets are now vulnerable, and so even if they're stored, they've got stuff and have it there, it can still be taken out. So it's a complex thing. They've got stuff, they're trying to build more, but they don't really have enough to make big breakthroughs.
Samantha?
I think we have to be really careful in overestimating Russia's weapons problems. I mean, they have put the economy on a complete war footing. They are asking certain companies to switch production to weapons production in a way that is much easier for any Western country to do because of the way the Russian economy is structured and also the political system, which allows Putin to say to companies, if you don't fulfill military orders, you will be sanctioned. There's also been some interesting information coming from analysing some of the latest surface-to-air missiles that have been thrown on Kiev. And marks on those missiles suggest they were produced very recently, this year, in fact. Some of them were produced, it looks as though they were produced between July and September, and some as late as November 2022. And this somehow contradicts many of the analysis that we had earlier on in the war, which said that Russia will find it much harder to produce some of the newer generation missiles because of the lack of microchips. And there was a very interesting article in the New York Times at the end of last year, which said that it looks as though Russia has actually been stockpiling the kind of precision microchips it needs to produce some of the more precision missiles, which is something that we will definitely have to keep an eye on.
Can we just look at now the economic impact the war and sanctions are having on Russia? I mean, last time we visited this subject in this way, Russia was surviving on its energy sales with a slow attrition of sectors such as aerospace. Shashank, what's your understanding of the picture now?
Well, what's clear is that they're willing to put a lot of their national output into defence. And so while the economy has taken an enormous hit, what's clear is that they're willing to spend a far, far greater percentage of GDP on military expenditure than any Western country would be. So, for example, the 2023 Russian budget calls for a 34% nominal increase in defence spending, so absolutely enormous. And I think we're not exactly sure, because a lot of their military spending is basically obscured and secret, but experts I've spoken to suggest that we're looking perhaps at well over 8% of Russian GDP being spent on defence, perhaps even double digits. Now, you know, for context, most NATO countries spend around or usually less than 2% of GDP.
Samantha Debendon, there must be a significant price paid in opportunity costs for doing that, because you have to divert the money from one place to another.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we're seeing in Russia right now, and these are figures that have been issued by the Russian statistical agency, Rostat, that you've seen car industry going down by about 79%. The aviation industry has taken a tremendous hit. People can't actually repair their cars anymore because there are no components and because a lot of the industry is being diverted to a war economy setting. Another thing which is also hitting the economy is conscription. Because a lot of men are being sent to fight at the war, which means manpower is now lacking, particularly in small enterprises who are losing some of their significant key management staff and are probably going to have to close this year, which will again lead towards a consolidation of the economy in state-owned large enterprises.
Laurie Friedman, just after Christmas, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping held talks, and there was some discussion then that there might be ways in which the Chinese could help bail the Russians out economically, not by giving them weapons, but by buying energy exports. Are you seeing any signs of a Russian-Chinese rapprochement which might help the Kremlin?
Not really. I mean, the Chinese are quite happy to take advantage of Russian neediness by taking their oil. There's new pipelines being built for gas, and they'll do it, as far as one can see, on a pretty transactional basis. I think Xi's support for Putin has become a little bit of an embarrassment for Beijing, so they're not going to make a big song and dance about whatever help they give them, and I think it's limited. So it's a factor. I mean, China and India, for that matter, are not supporting sanctions against Russia, but a lot of their companies are very well aware that they don't want to fall foul of sanctions. So it's not a way out for Russia. I think the economic dimension is an important factor, but I don't think it's going to be decisive in how this war comes to a conclusion.
Shashank Joshi, let's turn to Ukraine now. Vladimir Zelensky said earlier this week that Russia was planning to exhaust Ukraine with drone attacks. Is Ukraine in danger of exhaustion?
I think probably not. The attacks are relentless and having a serious impact on the power grid. And the power grid, in turn, is causing all sorts of knock-on problems with water supply, sewage pumping, all of those other things. And when my magazine, The Economist, interviewed Valery Zaluzhny, Ukraine's commander-in-chief, a few weeks ago, he said this is a problem for his men whose families are freezing and cold back in cities. And so building up reserves is difficult under those conditions. But ultimately, we know historically that these kind of strategic bombing attacks rarely work in the absence of an effective, coherent ground campaign. You know, we have some examples where you can argue they've perhaps worked. The NATO bombing of Serbia in 1999, in the Kosovo War, for example. But, you know, that was a very different sort of campaign. And for Serbia, you know, this wasn't an existential problem for them to change their approach. For Ukraine, it would be. In World War II, of course, there was major strategic bombing. But the studies after the war showed that actually its effect was often fairly limited. And in terms of morale, it often actually stiffened morale. And of course, the UK knows that from its experience in the Blitz. So I think that this is a problem for Ukraine's power grid, a really serious one, particularly if they continue to launch these attacks on a Monday, knocking out the grid, forcing Ukraine to work all week to fix it, and then launching another attack the following week. But ultimately, it is not going to compensate for Russia's lack of serious offensive capacity on the battlefield, and it's not going to compensate for their weaknesses on the front lines themselves.
Laurie Freeman, I suppose you could paint two broad scenarios, one in which Ukraine maintains its position and Russia can't advance any further, and another in which Ukraine actually advances. Now, in either of those situations, what is Ukraine going to need in order to be able to keep going?
It needs three things. First, it needs help in just keeping its economy going. Secondly, it needs help in sustaining the attacks on its critical infrastructure, which means more air defences. And these things are coming in. There's some evidence that the Russian attacks are now less effective. Countries adjust to these sort of things. It's always one of the problems for the reasons Shashank gave. It's amazing how populations adapt to all sorts of challenges, and the Ukrainian population has adapted. I mean, some places they've just had to leave, like in Kherson City, where they're being in a different sort of regular attack from artillery as well as from cruise missiles and drones. And then third, they've got to work out how much they can help Ukraine to mount offensives. If you look at Ukrainian sources, they don't really quite have enough. Now, they're always going to say this because they always want more and they want to keep the pressure on their Western suppliers to keep it coming in. But there clearly are some difficulties. They're not short of manpower, but they are short sometimes of artillery shells themselves, but they want heavier equipment, and which is going to become more important as the ground hardens again and maneuver becomes more possible.
Samantha, I want to turn now to the question of who's supplying Ukraine and the burden that such a supply can place on those countries. Just before Christmas, Volodymyr Zelensky flew to Washington and sought ongoing support from Joe Biden. To what extent did he succeed?
I read a very interesting article in CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis, which talks about US defense spending. And so far, the US has committed between 5 and 6% of its defense budget to helping Ukraine defend itself. The result of this has been the destruction of about half of Russia's conventional weaponry. So in terms of sort of expense to gain ratio, one could argue that this is an incredibly profitable investment for the US. The United States have now said that they will supply air defense Patriot missiles to Ukraine. It remains to be seen when they will be delivered. And there's also quite a long training process to be able to use these weapons. After the visit, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg actually said, the West needs to provide more weapons to Ukraine. So the next few months will show how really successful this was, but there have been more pledges and pledges of different types of weapons.
Shashank Joshi, one of the things that's happened in the last few months is, for example, the US Congress, the House of Representatives, has shifted party. Do you see any significant danger of a drawing down of US commitment as a consequence of political change?
I think the risk of America's Congress choking off aid is far less now than perhaps we thought it was a few months ago. American Republicans are more skeptical of Ukraine and the war effort than Democrats are. It's become a polarized issue. But in general, they are not against any aid at all. They are in favor of better accountability because some of them view Ukraine as a corrupt country that can't be trusted. That goes back, of course, to the role that Ukraine played in the impeachment of Donald Trump a few years ago, and also to the experience of Afghanistan, where spending in Afghanistan became a very political polarizing issue. But apart from that, I think we're still seeing the Biden administration is able to secure fairly large drawdowns of equipment for the Ukrainians.
Samantha, one of the things that was supposed to impact upon European support for Ukraine was that we would hit an energy crisis this winter as Russian supplies of oil and gas diminished, and that was going to lead to huge strains, etc. How has that actually turned out?
Well, it's actually turned out better than expected, partly because we have had an unusually mild winter so far. You know, wearing T-shirts in parts of Northern Europe on New Year's Day is something that is quite unheard of. But the risk is clearly there that European public opinion will begin to experience war fatigue. There have been some polls across Europe showing that although support is still around 50% across the European Union as a whole, and I'm not including the UK here, it has gone down a little bit since the beginning of the war. And it is, of course, a risk. And this is where I think politicians have a really important role to play. And if any politicians are listening to this, please take note. Because one message that needs to be sent to public opinion in the UK, in Europe as a whole, is that if the war in Ukraine stops tomorrow, if we stop supporting Ukraine, we let Russia gobble up part of Ukrainian territory, does that mean that the energy crisis, that the cost of living is suddenly going to improve? Are we going to suddenly switch to trading with Russia the way we did before? Are we going to actually give in to this blackmail just to get our cost of living up? And then what will happen the next time Putin decides to blackmail us? So by being tough today, by supporting Ukraine today, this is ensuring long-term, not only military security in the Euro-Atlantic space, but the security of our energy infrastructures, because it is forcing us to diversify. And the same goes for our dependence on the whole part of Eastern Europe and Russia that supplies us with our foodstuffs and our grains, various grains, not only wheat, but barley and maize as well. So this is a really important message, that stopping support to Ukraine today will not mean that tomorrow all the energy woes and other inflationary pressures will disappear.
Laurie Freedman, as we come to the question which you must always hope people like me don't ask, are we going to be having this conversation again in 6 months from now, or even a year?
It'll be a different conversation. I think Putin has banked on trying to get some sort of result quite quickly. He's thrown everything possible since September, when I think they had the big Ukrainian breakthroughs on the ground, and it really looked like the Russian position was wobbling. He's doubled down. The political demands have increased with the annexations. Mass mobilization came in. He had a much more deliberate attacks on Ukrainian civil infrastructure, critical infrastructure. All of those things happened in September. And I think he was also hoping Western support would buckle under the strain of a tough winter. None of this is really going that well for him. It certainly held the Ukrainians up and made life miserable for Ukrainians. So I think if this is still going on in the spring, which is perfectly possible, and Russia hasn't made any more breakthroughs and indeed has lost more territory, then I think questions are going to have to be asked in Moscow about how long this can be sustained. Equally, if the battle lines look more or less as they are at the moment, then I think Ukrainians are going to be under some pressure, because a lot of the support does depend on the Ukrainians using their weaponry effectively. The Ukrainians are going to be under some pressure as well.
Shashank, what do you think?
My assessment, David, is that in 6 months, the most likely scenario is one in which Ukraine has succeeded in taking back more of its territory, but nonetheless remains short of restoring the battle lines or the front lines that prevailed on February 24th at dawn in 2022. So there will still be large amounts of territory in Russian hands. And in particular, I think it very unlikely that the Ukrainians will have taken Crimea or gone all the way up to Crimea's borders. And so at that point, the Ukrainians will have demonstrated success, but nevertheless, the Russians will constantly hold out hope that by mobilizing another 100,000 here, another 100,000 there, they can not only staunch the bleeding, as to some degree they have done in the last month, but also go back on the offensive. That will be a sort of chimerical goal that will infuse the Kremlin's thinking on this, pushing it to prolong this war long beyond what is sensible.
And finally, Samantha, say it's just the long haul.
Yes, I think that we're in for a long haul. The crunch, I think, will come towards the end of this year, barring any black swans, you know, unknown unknowns that could arise before then, because we're going to be entering towards 2024 when you have presidential elections, both in Russia and in the United States. And that is going to put pressure on both sides to try and see some kind of significant change in Ukraine. All that, of course, is barring a catastrophe, which would be Russia getting fed up and Putin ceding to the pressure that he's already under to use more unconventional warfare in Ukraine. I don't see that as a possibility, but it cannot be discounted. First of all, if Russia loses more territory in Ukraine and is not able to show any sort of significant victories, then the pressure will rise to potentially use a tactical nuke in Ukraine. I don't think this will happen, but it will certainly create a lot of tensions in the Kremlin, which could lead to changes inside Russia. I see this more happening towards the end of the year as the election deadline approaches. So yes, I think we will be having a conversation in 6 months' time and a conversation of sorts this time next year.
Samantha Dependent there with Shashank Joshi and Lawrence Friedman. My thanks to them and to Michael Clark. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstein Knight and Dan Gordon. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one on whether we can colonise the moon, the one about how we deal with an ageing population, and the one about how reform of the House of Lords might work.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, no, millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. These are the new gurus.
Just as people will say the Protestant Reformation and the printing press went hand in hand, so too did this birth of the new internet culture really give rise to this new religious landscape.
Subscribe now to The New Gurus on BBC Sounds.
In Turkey, if you're willing to take a detour, you'll discover the food even social media hasn't got to yet. From Michelin stars and wine in Urla to traditional recipes and the home of baklava in the east. Discover the culinary capital of Gaziantep and talk to the locals. Every dish has its own story. Flavours, experimentation and tradition, Turkey has it all. Plan your detour at goturkey.com.
Kann eine Karriere neugierig sein? Komm zu EY und erlebe es selbst. Arbeite an spannenden Projekten, gestalte die Wirtschaft von morgen und entwickle dich auch selbst weiter. Im Team Assurance, Tax, Consulting oder EY Parthenon, Strategy and Transactions. Shape your future with confidence. Jetzt bewerben auf jobsgermany.ey.com.